Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sit-in on the floor of the House of Representatives by Democrats who are demanding a debate and vote on curbing gun violence in the wake of the latest mass shooting in Orlando. John Lawrence, a visiting professor at the University of California's Washington Center, who served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff, joins us to discuss the open-ended sit-in led by civil rights icon Representative John Lewis and the no-bill, no-break strategy the Democrats are using to force the House Republican leadership to vote on gun control legislation instead of offering moments of silence and prayers for the growing numbers of Americans routinely slaughtered by mentally disturbed loners and wannabe terrorists who find it easy to obtain military-style assault weapons, even if they are on the no-fly list of terrorism suspects. Then we'll examine the embarrassing rebuke the U.S. received from the International Monetary Fund, which warned today in its annual assessment of the U.S. economy about America's high poverty rate, with 1 in 7 Americans living in poverty, 40% of whom are working. Stephen Pimper, the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, joins us to discuss the IMF's call for the U.S. to urgently deal with its growing poverty and increasing inequality, recommending a raise in the minimum wage as well as the need to offer paid maternity leave and childcare to help poor Americans get jobs. Then finally, we'll speak with Dr. Susan McManus, the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and co-author of Florida Politics. She joins us to discuss former Republican presidential candidate Marco Rubio's reversal of his repeated insistence that he would not pursue another term in the U.S. Senate. We will look into what is likely to be a critical race in Florida to determine which party controls the next Senate that now has Rubio ahead in the polls, while the Democrats appear divided between a centrist preferred by the party establishment, Congressman Patrick Murphy, who faces a challenge from a wealthy liberal opponent, Congressman Alan Grayson. And joining us now is John Lawrence, who is a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Lawrence.
Thank you very much, Ian. Glad to be with you.
And John, do you think Nancy Pelosi was behind this? I know this didn't happen spontaneously. This was thought through, this sit-in or Occupy the House, as some are referring to it. What's your understanding of I know John Lewis basically gave a rousing speech, and that sort of was the cue for people to start the sit-in. So give us a sense, if you know, how this came about, because it's a pretty extraordinary turn of events.
My understanding is that it was a very much a spontaneous decision the Connecticut Congressman John Larson, who has been the former chairman of the House Democratic Caucus and very much involved in efforts on gun control following the shootings in Connecticut a couple of years ago, that he first broached this idea. I'm not sure whether it occurred at a caucus meeting, which are typically held on Wednesday morning, or whether or not it happened more in proximity to the floor, for example, in the cloakroom. But what happened was that almost immediately after the House came into session, there's always a prayer and there is a saluting of the flag, and then typically members are recognized for brief speeches, and it was at that very beginning of the session, during these so-called one-minute speeches, that Congressman Lewis spoke and announced that there would be this sit-in, and a large number, maybe 25 or so Democrats, joined him in the well of the House, that open area where the microphones are, and when he was finished, they sat down, and there they sit.
And it is open-ended, right? We don't know how long they'll sit. And fairly quickly thereafter, the House majority Republicans, I guess it was the Speaker, whoever was in the chair, gaveled the House into recess and cut off the C-SPAN cameras feed.
That's right. And so the C-SPAN cameras are controlled by the Speaker's office. And the agreement has always been that they would only cover actual sessions of the House. So once the presiding officer decided that they were going to adjourn the session because they found the sit-in too disruptive, then the microphones and the TV cameras were cut off. But because of the availability of cell phones and social media, the members themselves were able to stream coverage of the continuing speeches that were occurring on the floor.
I believe they're using the Periscope app, right, to get isn't C-SPAN picking up the feed?
Yes. I think C-SPAN was prepared to go ahead and do that. The C-SPAN is only governed with respect to the House floor for formal House sessions. So as soon as this became an unofficial session, the rules of the Speaker determining coverage, I think, probably really didn't apply. Now, they're scheduled to go out of session at the end of this week for a two-week Independence Day recess, and it was because of that pending recess that many Democratic members felt that inaction on gun legislation was called for, particularly after there was an agreement in the Senate earlier this week to bring up four different amendments that would have had imposed some type of control on individuals who appeared on the terrorist watch list or the no-fly list. The Senate, that was negotiated in the House, which, of course, is a majority-run institution. The Speaker really decides what's going to come up on the floor, and just as the Speaker has said, he's not going to bring up an immigration bill, or he didn't bring up a budget bill, or he didn't bring up a health care bill, he says we're not going to bring that up. There's really no alternative for the minority. There is no other procedure that realistically could be used to force a bill onto the floor or an amendment, and therefore they chose this very unorthodox way of making their point.
And again, I'm speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's chief of staff. Well, to go back to the Senate, though, last week, it's not as if Mitch McConnell agreed to having four bills debated on gun control in the wake of the Orlando massacre. He was forced into it largely by a filibuster from Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. So it's not surprising that that the Democrats have to resort to unorthodox methods, because quite simply, the Republicans are pretty clear that they don't want to deal with this issue, and they don't want to basically buck the NRA that seems to dictate what they do on this issue.
Well, I think that's a fair characterization. The use of the filibuster really did force McConnell's hand. Of course, he could have simply adjourned the Senate, but the Senate operates much more on a negotiated timetable than does the House, which is really controlled by the majority. And because there was bipartisan interest, I think McConnell felt that he had to allow at least some vote to occur. The votes were largely along party lines, not exclusively. But of course, they didn't reach the 60 vote threshold needed to cut off debate. And so none of them were able to pass. One of them did get a majority vote, but that's not, as we know, that's not enough in the Senate. In the House, not having those kinds of options for negotiations, they really had no alternative but to choose this. I'm a historian. I hate to say unprecedented because I haven't checked all the precedents, but I can't think of any other event where the House floor has been rendered inoperative by this kind of a floor demonstration. I think it really speaks to the sense of frustration and outrage that the members have over not having any opportunity to address this issue. You know, you had Sandy Hook, and you had the shootings in South Carolina, and you've had the shootings in Orlando, not to mention tens of thousands of other people who are killed, dozens and dozens of mass shootings. I think one mass shooting every week in the United States. And and still nothing being brought to the floor, not an amendment, not a bill. I think that frustration builds on people, and particularly when there's such an emotional event as Orlando, I think people simply felt they had to do something that members don't like to do, which is to go outside the rules and outside normal procedure, but really use this type of protest to make the American people aware that there are people in Congress who want to address this issue, who are prepared to vote on this issue, and are simply being prevented from doing so by the Speaker and by the majority.
Well, given that the civil rights icon, Representative John Lewis, began the sit-in, and it does have all those echoes of civil rights protests, the Occupy movement, you name it, the sit-in is a well-known kind of civil protest, but it usually results in the police coming in and physically removing people. And that, I take it, is the option that Paul Ryan has to bring in the Capitol Police. That would be a pretty inflammatory option, but how do you see this thing working out?
Supposedly, the Republicans are going to make a motion around now, around 8 o'clock Eastern time, to proceed with floor business. My assumption is that the Democratic members who are sitting in will not yield their position. At that point, yes, the Speaker could technically ask the Sergeant-at-Arms to clear the floor. I cannot imagine in my wildest dreams that would actually take place. It would be such a complete breach of protocol. So it's possible that they will simply allow the members to stay there and see what happens tomorrow. You know, this is not like a filibuster, where one person has to stay on his feet or her feet hour after hour after hour without yielding the floor. In this case, you could have 20 members on the floor now, and at midnight another 20 could come in, and these people could go home and have dinner or take a nap, and then in 6 or 7 hours another group. So you really have the ability to continue this occupation of the House floor with relatively fresh and energized people for really an unlimited period of time. And I think that, you know, if you get to about Thursday midday and nothing's happened, my guess is they'll just adjourn for the, or they'll recess for the July 4th holiday without taking any further action. I would guess that you will see Democrats offer to bring up a variety of different bills or try to address this in some way. Their goal is not to occupy the floor, obviously, it's to force a vote. But I don't. I think having gone down this road now, it would be ill-advised for them to give up too easily. And I think that it won't be until they literally recess for the July 4th break that you'll see this occupation. And unless the Republican leadership was to capitulate and agree to have a series of votes. Now, the problem, of course, with having a series of votes on this issue is that, unlike the Senate, you don't need a supermajority. So if somebody were to put a bill on the floor, the Speaker were to agree to have an amendment or a bill on the floor that, for example, was a bipartisan proposal to prohibit people on the terrorist non-fly list from purchasing automatic weapons, that's a pretty tough vote to cast. And my guess is it may very well get a majority of votes. And that, of course, would not be welcomed by not only the NRA, but by the Gun Owners Association of America, which is an even more extreme and politically charged group. So they're sort of between the proverbial rock and a hard place here.
But that issue, though, the so-called terror gap, the idea that you have in this country 81,000 people on the terrorism watch list and a no-fly list. Only 2,700 of those people are American citizens. The rest are foreigners, I guess, with green cards. So this is what's so surreal about it. The entire effort to do anything about gun violence and these repeated and recurring massacres is held hostage by the rights, allegedly, of 2,700 people who perhaps may not, some of them may not and should not be on that list. Why can't you have a procedure which reviews the list and gives people the right to challenge their status as being on the no-fly list, as opposed to hold hostage all efforts to deal with these recurring massacres? It's a joke to me. I don't know why anybody's taking them seriously.
Well, I think that you're assuming that there would be a good faith effort on the part of the NRA or on the part of the Gun Owners of America to develop a reasonable, workable policy to curb gun violence and the purchase of these military-style assault weapons and cartridges, which doesn't really exist. They're not interested in finding a workable solution. They view any restriction whatsoever as the first step in the legitimization of gun control, which will ultimately end with the confiscation of all guns. Now, I don't know if anybody seriously believes that, but that is the way in which the NRA not only frames its political issue, but it's also the way in which it recruits membership and whips its groups into its membership into political action. So they are not interested in seeing capitulation. They're interested in taking these extreme positions because that is what is helpful for them, both in a political and in a financial sense. So there is no goodwill there. It's not that we couldn't sit down and craft a workable process either for reviewing the no-fly list or for limiting the restrictions on gun ownership to some portion of that list. It's that there's no interest in doing that because it's viewed as the first step towards the so-called goal of complete confiscation of weapons. So there's just not the good faith there you need for a legislative activity to occur.
But it seems to me though, John Lawrence, that I think the situation is changing, that the NRA and the Gun Owners of America and others have always taken the last bit of the Second Amendment to be, engraved in, like in a pillar of stone. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But the predicate is a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people, etc. Now, I know that Heller, that Scalia pushed through the Supreme Court ruling, somewhat turned that on its head. But you cannot continue this insanity in this country without revisiting the Second Amendment in terms of particularly being necessary to the security of a free state. As long as people can buy these military-style weapons, we are not a secure or a free state. As long as our innocent citizens are slaughtered, we are not a secure and free state. It's an absolute travesty.
Now, let me put on my historian's hat here instead of my political hat for a second and just say that I don't disagree with you at all with respect to the Second Amendment. There actually is an interesting new book called On the First Congress that was published last year by a historian in California named Fergus Border, which looks at the way in which the Constitution was implemented by the First Congress in the 1790s. And virtually no attention was given to the Second Amendment during that debate. And the reason was because, as you suggest, on its face, it was obvious that people had to have weapons in order to have a militia that was necessary for national defense. There was no standing army at the time. There were very few organized militias at the state level. So people had to be able to be called up at a very short notice and be not only possess weapons, but also know how to utilize weapons, because that was still in the 1790s and even into the early 1800s, a very insecure time for this young country. Now, over time, obviously, that has been perverted into something much, much different than that notion of an armed citizenry in order to help defend the country. And it's now an armed citizenry to conduct violence against other citizens. And that's very different than self-defense or hunting or target practice. We're talking here about weapons which have no use other than military uses. And I think the frustration that you are articulating and that I feel as well is partly due to the fact that well over 70% of the American people agree that some rational limitations are needed on assault weapons and on background checks and on the access of people on the terrorist list two weapons. And the frustration comes when you cannot get your elected representatives to even conduct a debate on the floor, to even conduct a hearing in the House of Representatives. I think that really contributes to that sense of frustration on the part of the citizenry and towards their cynicism towards government, because they see government unwilling to address what is unquestionably a matter of life and death for you know, something like 70,000 people a year who are being killed by guns.
Well, John Lawrence, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian. I enjoyed talking with you.
And again, I've been speaking with John Lawrence, who's a visiting professor at the University of California, Washington Center, who worked in the House of Representatives for 38 years and served as House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's Chief of Staff. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the IMF's warning that the United States must deal with immediately with its issue of poverty. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Pimper, who is the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He teaches U.S. social policy and social welfare history at Columbia University and NYU, and has a forthcoming book, Ghettos, Tramps, and Welfare Queens, Down and Out on the Silver Screen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pimper.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here, although I should point out that I am now at the University of New Hampshire.
Well, I will change the bio. And nevertheless, the IMF today, in its annual report on the U.S. economy, went out of its way to deal with the issue of poverty and pointed out that there one in seven Americans are living in poverty, 40% of whom are working. And they suggested that there are things that the U.S. could do, not just about poverty, which you think is a moral issue and a moral disgrace, but also they've couched it in practical terms, that you actually you need to deal with poverty in order to improve your economy. So how did it strike you, it seemed like the IMF, in a way, was rebuking the United States?
Well, I mean, I think it's always useful to take anything that the IMF offers by way of proclamation with a grain of salt. They have, let's say, a mixed track record at best, and they are, you know, a collection of economists like any other and subject to the same, narrow frame of reference and biases. That said, in this report, I think there's a lot that's of interest. They actually identified sort of four categories of problem. They talked about labor force participation, the number of working age adults who are in fact working, and found that the declining number of folks participating in the labor market was troubling. They were concerned about productivity, the overall economic output of the economy. They were concerned with polarization, what we often refer to as economic inequality, but interestingly weren't only worried about the economic effects, but were also sort of very gently suggesting that that might give rise to some social or some political concerns if we were to see increasing inequality. And then finally, as you mentioned, they also did once again draw attention to the fact that the United States has one of the highest poverty rates of any rich democracy on the planet, and that has shown really no considerable improvement over the last 30 years or so. And then they went on to offer a series of solutions And I guess my read is that those solutions are very much a mixed bag, and that even when the policy recommendations they make are good, they're confused, and some of the recommendations are out and out, I think, bad recommendations that will in fact increase poverty rather than reduce it.
Well, just to sum up what the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, said, quoting, "Our assessment is that if left unchecked, these four forces, participation, productivity, polarization, and poverty, will corrode the underpinnings of growth and hold back gains in U.S. living standards." So unquestionably, if you have one of the highest poverty rates in the world, you it does relate to the overall living standard, surely. And what is your explanation as an historian of this issue? Why are we in this situation where, and we know what the political manifestations of it are, there are a lot of angry people out there that have flocked to both Bernie Sanders and to Donald Trump. We see the anger, and we are aware of the inequality. So where would you place us in the historical context?
Well, you know, in some ways, there's either nothing new about this observation, and it's been a long time coming. I mean, if you look at what's sometimes referred to as the golden age of American capitalism, those years immediately following World War II, when if you were a white northerner, and that caveat is exceedingly important, but if you were a white northerner, the economy was doing, in fact, very well. We had the highest levels of economic growth year after year that we've seen throughout our history, and that growth was being distributed pretty equitably across the population. This was sometimes thought of as the boom years of the American economy from the mid-1940s up until the 1970s. And part of how we achieved that, again, is not any particular mystery. It is the peak of the American labor movement we can look at in about the mid-1940s. We can see the radical expansion of the American welfare state under FDR and the New Deal programs of the 30s that were up until the 70s built on and expanded by Democrats and Republicans alike. We can see a labor market that provided jobs that offered a decent living with the ability to buy a house and maybe put your kids through school with only a high school diploma, and general upward mobility that was purchased in part through very high marginal tax rates on corporations and individuals up at the other end. So, I mean, we see a very large comprehensive welfare state, a strong unionization base that puts pressure on those political institutions. We see elected officials who feel beholden to those institutional working class pressures, so tend to deliver on the goods. And we see a tax system that was structured to actually generate the resources to do that. In that context, though I think a lot of politicians would tell you today, my God, that's a recipe for disaster, including, by the way, the IMF on some days, that's how we built the strong economy and growing equality rather than growing inequality.
Right. But if the IMF are calling us out, and the IMF, as you've pointed out, are not without sin, that, to my mind, makes it doubly damning, this report.
Well, I mean, it's sort of, it's a muddled mess, right? Because on the one hand, you know, they recommend increasing the earned income tax credit, which is terrific, but because of the way that we calculate poverty, that will have literally no effect on the official poverty rate. So that there's some real fundamental lack of understanding about where these data come from, and you would think the IMF would know better. They've also got a series of recommendations that I think are terrific and unobjectionable, increasing social welfare programs for the non-working poor, for example, that are not going anywhere, I would argue, in either the next Democratic or Republican presidency. And that's balanced with another set of recommendations that will make things worse. A strong argument for enacting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Turns out that's very hard to say. Pension reform, and they talk about both increasing the retirement age and using a thing that's called the chained CPI, which is fancy language for a benefit cut across the board that's going to wind up increasing poverty among the elderly, arguably the only group we've had good successes in reducing poverty with. And they spend a fair bit of time worrying about debt. But if we're worried about debt, then there's no chance that we're going to be able to commit ourselves to devoting the resources to do the things that would actually reduce poverty.
Right. The specter of debt has been flogged, beaten to death in the name of austerity, which we know makes things worse. But there were at least, you know, recommending a raise in the minimum wage, as well as a need to offer paid maternity leave and childcare to help poor Americans get jobs. That all seems to make a lot of sense. And you said that the halcyon days of America were effectively when it was a social democracy from about 47 to, or even early, if you like, to about 1977. But it seems to me that we mentioned the disquiet and anger, particularly amongst white working class Americans. The crash of 2008 and the subsequent the subsequent making whole of the very people responsible for that crash, none of whom went to jail. It was the biggest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the world. I can't remember, figures like 14 trillion, 20 trillion. I don't even know what the real figure is. I'm not sure anybody does. And then the idea that everybody got hosed, Main Street languishes, Wall Street's made whole again, and these people are even more arrogant and dismissive of the rest of us than they ever were. And our political class are completely in the pocket of these people. Isn't that the recipe for anger? And isn't that what...
I guess maybe that's part of my, we could even call it cynicism with the IMF report, is that they're making sort of a lot of easy pronouncements about policy changes that right now, for some of the reasons that you have just described, stands absolutely no realistic chance of being enacted.
Right.
So this kind of sort of easy set of policy recommendations without, in turn, a more substantive diagnosis of what I would argue is a problem of democracy as much as it is a problem of economics strikes me as simply a lazy effort to appear to be concerned about poverty without actually willing to use the force of the institution to do anything about it.
Right. And if we had a democratic revival in this country where people demanded that fairness, remember when Eisenhower was president and he was a Republican, the rich were paying 92% tax.
Mm-hmm.
If the people who are getting hosed in this country demanded equity, fairness, and changing the tax status, I mean, the only way you'd ever get to that is if the people actually ran Washington, not Wall Street, right? So do you put the ball back in the people's court?
Well, I mean, I think it's hard, right? Because I have a hard time blaming any American citizen who looks at the dysfunction of the system and their declining family fortunes and chooses not to participate. I worry about that and I bemoan that, but I don't blame individuals. And this is sort of part of the challenge that we face. And how do you mobilize people in the face of what is likely to be defeat after defeat after defeat after defeat before you find some success? And you know, I don't know anybody who's got an especially good answer to that question. I think that we have seen some interesting signs of what may be new mobilization coming out of the Sanders campaign. But I think the larger and most important question we confront right now is, will those activists be able to expand their activity to move into other kinds of political pressure? Will there be greater spaces where the Black Lives Matter movement and other more recent demands for economic justice and political justice, will they continue to push upon the system? And remember that we get the New Deal programs in the 1930s not because FDR wants them. FDR was as much an elitist as people accuse Hillary Clinton of being. FDR pushed through programs in the 1930s because he felt that he had no alternative, that if he didn't, his hold on office was insecure. That's the hope that we have, is both through electoral politics and movement politics, consistently putting pressure on whoever's in office too often force them to do things they don't necessarily want to do.
Well, just in closing, though, of course, the flip side to Bernie Sanders' proposal and the movement that he generated is the Donald Trump movement. And that is so sad to think that all of those angry people out there who are justifiably angry think that this guy is actually going to help them, this selfish, disgraceful, self-promoting buffoon. It is so tragic that that is where some 14 million people have put their faith in this guy so far, and now he's getting treated as a legitimate candidate because of our binary press system, where you have to say Hillary Clinton this and Donald Trump this. So he's already being promoted as a credible person instead of the disgrace and joke that he is.
Yeah, which is in itself, I think, potentially dangerous in very significant kinds of ways. I'd point out that those who are most likely to be most disaffected with the American political system right now are also those least likely to possess substantive knowledge of either politics or policy. Those are moments, and those are people who are, of course, ripe for the kind of demagogue that is Trump. It's not necessarily to excuse those individuals' behavior, but it is, I think, important that we understand where that comes from. Those are not necessarily people who share a coherent ideology, but rather are angry and scared and kind of like the sound of what's coming out of his mouth. And this is, of course, a recipe for all kinds of horrors in a putatively democratic system. But I do think that while it may be productive to demonize Trump, I'm not sure that it's productive to demonize people who associate themselves with him as voters.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Pimpare.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pimpare, who's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America, which was the winner of the Michael Harrington Book Prize. He teaches U.S. social policy and social welfare history at the University of New Hampshire and has a forthcoming book, Ghettos, Tramps, and Welfare Queens, Down and Out on the Silver Screen. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the return of Rubio in a critical race to decide who will control the Senate.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty, bitty rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man, I'd build.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Susan McManus, who's the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics. And she has served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan McManus.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And it looks like now that Senator Marco Rubio has reconsidered not running for the U.S. Senate seat again that he vacated to run for president, and on Wednesday he made the announcement that he was back in the race, obviously under the Republicans, I think Mitch McConnell had been twisting his arm. But it looks like this race is going to be not just key for who controls the Senate, but also a pretty tight race on both sides. You've got two competitive Democrats, and how competitive is the wealthy businessman who's going to be running against Rubio?
Well, there's not one. There's actually two wealthy businessmen. The second one is Todd Wilcox. He's not as well known, and he hasn't spent the money that Karl Marufe has, Both of them come from the private sector. They're reflective of the time period that we're in, where so many people are disgusted with what's happening in Washington and just want fresh faces everywhere. These people are bringing new people to the polls, as we saw in the primaries, the presidential primary. So Rubio is going to be facing two wealthy opponents. And it is true that a three-person race does probably work a bit to Rubio's advantage, because the other two will be sort of fighting for the people who are really disgruntled and want someone new. It's also true that in our primary, which is late, it's August 30th, turnout tends to be very low, in the low 20s. So what you're likely to have are party regulars, which usually means in the Republican primary, older voters, who may be more in the Rubio camp because they've seen polls that show that he can do better statewide than the other two gentlemen. But there's a lot of time that millions of dollars are going to be spent on TV ads, and Carl Baruff has said he's willing to spend $15 million at a minimum, and he's already started. So it is a very interesting race.
But in announcing today, Marco Rubio said, "It is no secret that I have significant disagreements with Donald Trump." And he wanted to say his positions on many key issues are still unknown, and some of his statements, especially about women and minorities, I find not just offensive but unacceptable. If he is elected, we will need senators willing to encourage him in the right direction and, if necessary, stand up to him. I have proven a willingness to do both. So how much do you think Marco Rubio was sort of tainted or branded by Trump in terms of little Marco? Has Trump done him some damage, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And the irony of all of this is, in a way, that it is now Trump who needs Marco Rubio if he were to get elected president, more than vice versa. But it's also true that in Florida, increasingly, as it's true across the country, that more and more people are voting a straight party ticket. So it is absolutely a high likelihood that whether Marco Rubio likes it or not, he's going to be tethered to Donald Trump, because people who vote, particularly newcomers, are drawn to the polls by whomever's at the top of the ticket, and then they just follow that party on down. So Rubio is certainly trying to distance himself, but the question is how effective that will be, because of the tendency of people to straight ticket vote and be drawn by the top of the ticket candidate, which in this case, of course, is Donald Trump.
But within that statement, there appears to be a certain, I don't know whether hypocrisy is too strong a word, but certainly a lack of, I think, moral clarity. Because on the one hand, you're saying, Marco Rubio is saying, that Trump has said things about women and minorities that are not just offensive but unacceptable. But, you know, we need senators willing to encourage him in the right direction. How do you encourage somebody that's sort of, in many ways, says things that are beyond the pale, and particularly Rubio himself being a member of a minority community, which, of course, is something that he is very anxious to let everybody know?
Well, of course, Marco Rubio and also Jeb Bush, his mentor, were both adamant in the whole presidential preference primary cycle that the party be attentive to diversity. And, of course, Florida Republicans, a number of them, are worried that the gains that the party made among minorities and women might be undone by the kind of rhetoric that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. So it's consistent from Marco Rubio, and Jeb Bush have repeatedly said that our party is not going to be well served by someone who is espousing the kind of language coming out of Donald Trump's mouth at this point.
Right. I think that the thing that I find a little odd, or perhaps not particularly likely to be successful, is the idea that you have to encourage somebody. I mean, but I guess the problem that Republicans have is that they're stuck with this guy, right? Even though there's something of a revive dump Trump movement amongst delegates. I think they've got about 500 now lined up against him. But, you know, at this point, nobody gives the Stop Trump movement particularly a lot of possibility of success. But that's, I guess, perhaps that's my opinion. But do you see an inconsistency there that, you know, you get insulted, but then you try and encourage the person to be nice?
Well, he has no option, really, because there are a lot of Republicans who are very offended by the language being used by Donald Trump on the trail, because keep in mind, Florida is one of the nation's most diverse states, and it's also one of the most competitive from a partisan perspective. So it really isn't inconsistent that Marco Rubio is saying that he's going to try to get Trump to change his ways. It is at least a better approach than saying, well, I don't like him, but I'm really 100% on board with him. That would also be a huge liability for Marco Rubio, particularly in trying to appeal to the independent voters, many of whom in Florida are very young. And independent voters make up almost one-fourth of Florida's voters these days.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, who's the Distinguished University Professor of Political Science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. So let's turn to the Democratic side. It does seem like... Given the advantage that that Marco Rubio has, presumably with name recognition and having been an incumbent, and certainly being a presidential candidate, for better or for worse, he got a lot of exposure. On the Democratic side, it seems that once again it's a case of fratricide. You've got Representative Patrick Murphy, who trails Rubio by 7 percentage points, 47-40. And you've got Representative Alan Grayson trailing Rubio 8 points, 48-40. But Harry Reid is not happy with having Grayson in the race in the first place. So are they going to cancel each other out?
Well, it's going to be a fierce fight as well, because each of those candidates is somewhat of a regional candidate. Murphy is stronger in South Florida, particularly Southeast Florida, which has a lot of Democrats, as you know. And Grayson is much more popular in the I-4 corridor, particularly the Orlando area. And Grayson is seen as more of a progressive and in the Bernie Sanders camp very strongly, whereas Murphy is seen as more of a traditional party establishment favorite. Harry Reid, of course, prefers him, and at the gathering of Democrats, the statewide gathering in South Florida last weekend, you had people like Congressman Clyburn coming down from Washington to campaign for Murphy, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, chair of the DNC, from the podium strongly supporting Murphy. So these two candidates, one is seen as anti-establishment and the other as more of an establishment candidate. So you, in a way, you have this similar schism within that party, and a lot of it's generational. Of course, Grayson capturing the younger vote, and Murphy of more of the older vote. Again, it goes back to one is very wealthy, which is Grayson, independently wealthy. Murphy more at the mercy of funding, raising funding from various contributors in the party and so forth. But it's, again, going to come down to turnout. Democrats have historically seen very poor turnout among younger voters in this August primary, which would seem to suggest that Murphy would be in the driver's seat. But both of them are going to have plenty of money. I think, in a nutshell, anybody that doubts that by the time it gets to the general election, that one or the other of these candidates, the Democrat or Republican, will be underfunded is not recognizing that Florida is one of a handful of states that's key to who controls the U.S. Senate, and there will be money pouring in here from everywhere. It will be a multi-million dollar Senate race on top of a hugely expensive presidential.
And given that these, in quotes, establishment Democratic figures have come down to campaign for Murphy, do you think Grayson could, if Bernie Sanders came down to campaign for him, would that make a difference? I mean, I guess the reason that Harry Reid doesn't support Grayson is he thinks that Murphy's better suited for the state's demographics. It's more of a purple state, isn't it?
Yes, it is a purple state. Yes.
So is that the logic here? That Grayson may not be able to be a statewide candidate?
Well, there are some other factors that have entered into the Reid equation, I think, in terms of looking at collegiality within the Congress, that Murphy seems to have gotten at least the reputation of being a little bit more collegial than Grayson, who is somewhat flamboyant, to put it mildly. And the temperament is probably one of the factors that's driving Reid to prefer Murphy, as well as the demographics.
So what is the residue, do you think, of this a tragedy in Orlando that's not just shaken Florida, but obviously shaken the whole country? Is there any way to suggest any kind of political fallout from the horrible massacre in Orlando?
Clearly, the whole gun control issue is one of the biggest issues to come out of the horrible Orlando massacre, and of course the terrorism issue as well. So you get what the Gallup poll has shown, which people tend to be very split as to how they looked at that tragic event. So for Democrats, they tend to see it more as a gun control issue, and Republicans more as a terrorism issue. But in terms of how that might play out, in looking at some of the previous election data and polling, it seems that it's going to play out most with women voters, and women voters make up 53% of Florida's electorate. The key is often, how are suburban women going to vote, and how in general is this whole gun issue playing with women? And it's not just the terrorism aspect, is all of these random shootings that have occurred in heretofore safe places like churches and schools and malls and restaurants. That is certainly something that grabs women's attention, particularly women with children and grandchildren. So I think in that sense, how the gun issue is cast may have a pull in our state with women voters.
And it's always been assumed that the Miami Cuban vote is key to Florida, and that Marco Rubio, being from that community, is something of a shoo-in. But on the other hand, my understanding is that that vote has shifted with the generations and is not as rigid as it was before, and is in some ways a little more liberal. So how do you think there are two big demographics, at least I'm aware of, and that is the Cuban vote and the seniors vote. You mentioned the women, but aren't those other two big factors?
The senior vote is not nearly what it used to be in power at all, because what has happened is that, unbeknownst to many people outside of Florida, the rise of the millennials and the Gen Xers has occurred, with people still assuming old stereotypes about Florida, that everybody here is elderly and that you can only talk about Social Security in a positive manner. The bottom line is, currently in Florida, if you take the millennials, 18 to 34-year-olds, plus the Gen Xers, the generation slightly older than them, right now those two groups make up 48% of Florida's registered voters. The idea that this is a senior-dominated state is really an old one that's not true anymore. And in terms of the Hispanic vote, it's very, very diverse. For example, and you mentioned the generational aspects of the Cuban vote, the younger Cubans lean Democratic. They're more concerned about domestic policy than Cuba. And you also have the rise of the Puerto Ricans, which have had a huge influx into the Orlando area with the onslaught of the economic failures in Puerto Rico. A lot of families moved in here just since the 2012 election, but we also have sizable Mexican population, and in South Florida, Nicaraguan, Venezuelan, Colombian. This is a very diverse Hispanic group that's not as cohesive as the black vote, which is still solidly Democratic. So things are really changing in Florida. It's a state whose demographics are constantly in flux because we have so many people moving in from everywhere else, Latin America plus other parts of the country. And then you have the generational shifts, and Florida politics are still shifting. But it's also true that the last three major state elections, the 2010 governor's race, the 2012 presidential, and the 2014 governors, the winner only prevailed by 1%. So this is a very, very competitive state with 29 electoral college votes. It's the biggest swing state in the country.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Susan McManus, you mentioned that with Trump at the top of the ticket, that the many people will just vote down ticket Republican all the way. But of course, Trump is an unusual candidate, not the least of which is his own party has an enormous amount of disquiet about him. And we don't even know whether at some point or other they're going to figure a way to get rid of him. So that's whole issues in flux. On the other hand, the Democrats, if they vote straight down the ticket, will have Hillary Clinton at the head of the ticket. And given that you said the women's vote is important, particularly in context of gun control, does that automatically give Hillary Clinton an advantage in the state?
Not necessarily, because the young millennial women don't like her particularly. After all, they were heavy Sanders voters. So you have sort of identified one of the mysteries and the difficulties of projecting who's going to win in Florida right now, because you have each party with key portions of their traditional bases that are up for grabs or face the possibility of either not voting because they don't like the top of the ticket candidate or crossing over to the other side. And we don't know what portions that might happen. So, for example, Democrats are worried about the millennials, particularly the young women millennials, also worried a bit about the working class, blue-collar male who voted for Sanders in the primary, presidential primary. Will the young women ultimately come back to Hillary, or will they just not vote at all? In terms of the working class white male, will that person cross over and vote for Trump, or will they vote for Hillary or just not vote at all? And then on the Republican side, you've got the never Trump people, and will they just stay home, or will, for example, suburban Republican women end up crossing over to vote for Hillary, or will they just not vote at all? So key portions of each party's base that we don't know whether they're going to stay with the party nominee, not vote at all, or a portion of them cross over and vote for the other party's nominee.
Well, it certainly makes an interesting race, and I hope to be able to follow it further with you, Dr. Susan McManus.
Well, thank you. I'd love to talk again.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan McManus, who's a distinguished university professor of political science at the University of South Florida and the co-author of Florida's Politics. She served as chair of the Florida Elections Commission from 1999 to 2003 and helped draft Florida's Help America Vote Act state plan required by Congress to qualify for federal funding under the Help America Vote Act. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.